The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So one of the pleasures of my life, my adult life, has been my engagement in Buddhism. The practice of Buddhism, the study of Buddhism, and the fortune of being teaching Buddhism. And if I look back over these decades that I've been involved, it's gone through phases, or it's gone through kind of variety of different steps of my relationship to all this. And in a sense, it's become more and more multidimensional. And I think that for people who stay involved in Buddhism for some time, that probably there are changes in how we understand or relate or participate in the practice and the teachings. And where maybe it also, you get the feeling this metaphor of dimensions makes sense, where it kind of gets more multidimensional. So, for example, if we have a one-dimensional relationship to Buddhism, it might be that we've heard one particular teaching, and it's like a sentence or something, and like maybe the sentence that everything is impermanent. And well, that's a kind of interesting statement, and it's maybe interesting, or a simple statement might be that some people have heard is that desire is the condition or the cause for suffering. And some people find that this, you know, one line like that sometimes is confusing, sometimes is very impactful, and they'll live with that. But it's kind of just a one little sentence. And then you might learn the context for those sentences, those little teachings. They fit into a wider kind of set of teachings. And that might be more two-dimensional. You start feeling the richness of it and why it's being said and the purpose it's being said, those particular teachings. And they don't meant to be stand alone. They're meant to be part of a larger kind of ecology of teachings. So then it might become more two-dimensional. And then a person might all along or at some point they start practicing with those, and then they realize that those practices, those teachings, have a context in their own practice, in their own life. And then it, all kinds of interesting things happen. We start looking at how we can practice them or how they apply them to our lives. We might feel that, well, they don't make sense for me in my life and my background, and then we debate them or argue with them or try to kind of go deeper in them and kind of, you know, and explore them and expand them or stretch them or adapt them so they work for us or something. But it becomes kind of a living relationship with them, so it becomes more three-dimensional now. And, you know, it's like, not just the particular idea, not just the wider context of what the Buddha might have taught, but now it has to do with, you know, our own lives and stuff. And then perhaps if we keep the metaphor of dimensionality, then maybe there's four dimensions. If at some point we not just look at, you know, what it's like for us personally, but we also start kind of the interface with our culture and our society. And so how does this work more widely in my engagement in the society and the world around me, or my understanding of what goes on in the environment or the society? And so it gets richer and richer, all this. And then, you know, all these dimensions keep working and deepening and moving, and things change over time. I suspect that if I had, so that certainly happened for me over my decades now of practice. And I suspect that if I had stopped my practice involving Buddhism at any of those phases or points along the way, those dimensionalities, I would have stayed, my understanding of the Dharma or Buddhism then would have kind of gotten frozen at the time I stepped out of Buddhism. I was like, that's what it is. For me, because I kept going, I said, no, it wasn't quite just that, it was actually changed and became something different, or, kept growing. And so, you know, each of you, in some way or other, whether you're here the first time or you've been doing this for a long time, you know, you'll be hearing the teachings or engaging the teachings from your particular situation now, and which is hopefully wonderful. And then, but it'll also change and develop. And just, you know, if you really get into this Buddhism stuff, you know, it, maybe it's like, you know, a marriage where, you know, that you're committed, but, you know, it can be a little bit strained sometimes. So sometimes, you know, relationship to Buddhism can be a little bit, you know, strained, but, and which party is most responsible, do you have to decide. And so I wanted to give you an example of this for myself, from my life, of what's been a very significant part of my journey along this practice, and that is around the topic of intention. And it maybe it's represented as being important by a very common idea that the second step of the Eightfold Path is right intention. So when I first came into Buddhism, I was practicing Zen, and classic Buddhist teachings were not that important in Zen when I was practicing there. It was there kind of on the edges, sometimes it'd be talked about, but it didn't really have a central focus for what we were doing. And in Zen practice, there's not a lot of instructions. So there's not a lot of instructions about how to work with the mind and the technique of meditation practice. And there's good reasons not that why in Zen they don't give instructions, because there's a whole different orientation around what practice is. But compared to what we do in Vipassana, this insight meditation, it's quite dramatic, the difference between the detailed instructions we give and the almost absence instructions there. There's strengths and weaknesses in both sides. But at some point, I'd learned a little bit about this insight practice. And I asked some of the teachers there, why don't we talk about meditation practice in Zen? You know, the details of what goes on. And the answer I got back was, no. What we do is we talk about our intention. Zen involves a purification of our intention, and everything follows from that. And I thought that was a pretty wise answer in some ways. That and I've noticed this, that if we just keep paying attention to the purpose, the values, the attitudes that we bring to our practice, that's probably like 90% of what helps us develop the meditation practice. And and if we get a good attitude going, that it kind of just things just follow kind of almost naturally from itself in meditation. You don't have to actually do that much then. And so I think a lot of the insight instructions, we slowly begin seeing what we're actually doing and then starting to, you know, correct for it or change it. And so it becomes how what we do is in harmony with being present in a peaceful and nice way. But in Zen, the idea was they focus on that directly. And in fact, that's what I found very helpful in my Zen practice. And I got it early in my Zen practice, I got the idea to spend a lot of time looking at what was my deepest intention. What was the kind of central purpose for which I wanted to live my life, or the intention for I wanted to organize my life around. And so I spent a lot of time doing that, sometimes on a daily, made it practice on a daily basis. I said, what is my deepest intention? And I would watch from day to day. Sometimes it didn't change, and sometimes it changed. But because I kept asking the question and looking at it, I had a chance to shift and change it. I could look at what my answer was, and then not just live with that answer as a fixed thing, but rather keep looking at it, do angles, see if I can refine it, see if there's something else. Interesting thing I discovered was that if I stated my deepest intention with a negative statement, that I found it useful to try to reframe it positively. So what I mean by this, if my deepest intention was to live without fear, that's valuable. But then I'd ask myself, for what purpose? Or what would be the positive side of that? And then I'd find that I would come, you know, if I, the positive side of living without fear, what I wanted to do was to live with love, with compassion. And then, oh, that's interesting. And then it became kind of a different thing. Oh, you know, it became, oh, maybe I don't have to focus so much on living without fear. I thought that was important. But I could actually access the love or the compassion more directly. And that seems good, too. And so, but so I kept kind of looking at this and looking at that then. One variation of that was that I did for a year was I asked myself in the morning what I would do if I knew I was going to die in the evening. And that's an interesting question. If you're told you're going to die in 10 years, that's okay. 5 years, I did this exercise with someone once. Kind of in a workshop I was teaching, the kind of guided meditation. What would you do if you're going to die in a year? What would you do if you're going to die in 3 months? In a month? In a week? In 3 days? In a day? In 3 hours? In an hour? In 3 minutes? In a second? And so in a guided meditation, people are kind of following along, and it was very impactful for people to go through this. But I remember one woman came up to me and said, when it got back to 3 hours, then it got interesting. Because I live 4 hours away. And I could no longer go back home to clean my apartment or get everything, my affairs in order or something. And then I had to really face myself and really kind of look at what was important for me, because I had all these things that kind of distracted me that I felt were important. And another person, I went through it, luckily she told me a year later, and it was a happy ending, I guess. But she said, after that exercise, I quit my job. Because, what's important. So I would do that for a year, ask myself that question, and what would I do for if I was dying this evening? And that was very powerful, to look at what was most important for me, what was the most important thing I wanted to do in that kind of context, and how I wanted to engage my life, look at my life, do during that time. What did I really want to be in touch with during that time? So this continual kind of reflecting and refining, what is my deepest purpose or my deepest intention, I found so helpful. So then, at some point, I learned about the Buddha's teachings about the Eightfold Path. And again, in Zen, we would learn it sometimes more as just at least I learned it more as just a kind of abstract teaching at first that I didn't really understand or think about how I practiced with. And I learned this idea of right intention. And I just kind of thought, oh, that's a nice idea. I didn't really engage it much more. And then I also learned that right intention involves renunciation, the intention to renounce, whatever that means, the intention to live without ill will, the corollary being to live with friendliness and kindness, metta, to live without any sense of harmfulness or cruelty or wanting to harm. And the corollary of that is to live with compassion. So those seemed like good ideas, and I just filed them away as ideas for quite a while. And, and they were part of the overall teachings of the Buddha, so part of the two-dimensional kind of thing about Buddhism. But at some point, especially when I got involved in this insight tradition, then I started to think more about what do these mean, these right intention, and how do I live with them? And a very valuable way that I came to understand it is that as forms of reflection, before I do something, when I had to make a decision or was reflecting, what should I say in that situation, what should I do, what kind of decisions do I make about what I'm going to do, I found it helpful to ask myself, what is the intention behind it for sure, what's the purpose behind it? And that just was useful in and of itself. I was shocked to discover, if I asked myself, what's the purpose of saying what you're going to say, Gil? Why are you saying what you're going to say? It turned out that I had lots of purposes. You know, someone asks me, you know, where's the train station in Redwood City? And so the purpose is to give them information, right? That's it. It turned out that I wasn't that innocent. I might want to impress them that I'm a good direction giver, that I really know my things, you know, my directions well, and I'm an important person who knows the Redwood City, or I wanted to kind of boost up my self-esteem as being a helping person. You know, all these complicated things were going, layers and layers of right purposes. And so by keep asking that question, you know, what purpose do you have in saying what you're going to do? If I engage that honestly and kept looking and not just settling, I'm just giving them the information they asked for, I found actually it was really important for me to look at myself and see who I am and how I operate and begin to kind of be transformed by that information. But I found that with these three things, renunciation, kindness, and compassion, I would ask myself, is what I'm doing now, what I'm saying and do and decision to make, is it motivated by one of these things, some kind of letting go, some kind of goodwill, some kind of compassion for the situation, or maybe the opposite? Turns out sometimes my motivation was the opposite. It was kind of subtle sometimes. And sometimes, you know, these multidimensional purposes in which we operate on, I could have multiple intentions that motivate me. And so, yes, some of it was to be helpful, but some of it was because maybe, I don't know what, I'm late to get home. And I really want to get home, so part of my way and motivation to tell people directions to the train station is to just get them away from me quickly. I might like them, but, you know, there's this kind of certain, is that compassionate? Is that friendly? To just give them in directions, just like get them away so I can get home? You know, so I'd ask myself, what motivates you here? And what's, you know, is it kind? Is it compassionate? Am I letting go? The only reason I wanted to get home was maybe, who knows, maybe so that I could, I don't know, do Sudoku. And, you know, so I can let go of that. So I found it useful as a litmus test or as a way of looking at myself and questioning myself. And sometimes I found it helpful to have that kind of reference point. I didn't have so much the idea that I should be that way. I just found it useful to have that as a litmus test for myself. And I found that useful and to explore it and go into it more. And then I started discovering as the practice deepened that it didn't have to just be a litmus test or a reflection, that that letting go, renunciation, which is kind of like a big frightening word for some people, turned out it was simply an expression or a manifestation of a mind which has come to really love and feel at home in not clinging to things, not being attached to things and needing everything to be just right or being in control of things. And actually my heart, my mind is healthier and happier when I'm not holding tight to things. And so renunciation is less about giving something up as it is staying true to a heart, a mind, which just feels healthy and wise and good. And so and this idea of, or same thing with being kind or being friendly or having goodwill, turned out that a sense of goodwill also seemed to come out of how the heart naturally is. If I'm relaxed, if I'm settled, if I'm, you know, my mindfulness and clarity of mind is strong, it just, that seems to be what dwells in there. And so it wasn't so much that I had to become kind. It was more like, Gil, you know, you don't have to look at your, you know, what you're going to say and do and evaluate it that way. It's more like you've lost touch with it. You're a little stressed out, you're a little bit too busy, you're a little bit caught up in something. How about coming home to a healthy place of being? How about coming home, in a sense, to kind of more closer to what it feels like to really be true to myself or true or something? And so it was more like, a right intention is to come home. Same thing with compassion. It's coming home to compassion as opposed to, you know, obligated to be compassionate. And so right intention, I felt, was, you know, kind of a practice of coming home. So it was all these things. And the whole other way that I've started to think of it more recently, and that is that maybe a right intention has nothing to do with intention, or say it differently, maybe nothing to, maybe a right, this word we call the right intention, maybe it's too limited for what the second factor of the Eightfold Path is. And so then I looked into the Pali, the original text and languages, and tried to understand this word. The word is sankappa. And the more I looked at it, the less it looked like intention. Some translators translated it as resolve, so right resolve. And some translators have translated right aspiration. And I looked at that, and I looked at that, and, you know, that was pretty wonderful for me to use those terms and practice those ways. So it's beneficial to have those translations. But, you know, I don't know if this is what the Buddha had in mind. And so it made me wonder, maybe there's other meanings that I'm missing out on. Maybe there's, I can expand now beyond intention into some other domain of what it might mean. And so I looked at the ancient commentaries, I looked at texts, and it's very hard because the Buddha didn't define his words. And it was very difficult to... And I came to understand that the English translators have chosen intention, resolve, or aspiration. That's just their guess. It's really hard to do much more than guess. And I think that what happened a little bit is that in the history of Western philosophy and religions, the idea of will is really important. The idea of intention is really important. And so I think that Western translators of these ancient texts brought with them this very strong interest in finding intention in the suttas, in the Buddha's teachings, and then found words that fit this very important Western term and then translated in that way. And so my being a Westerner, maybe, partly, so it worked for me. It was beneficial. I benefited from that. I felt I grew because of that. But maybe if I go back and understand what the Buddha meant, maybe there's a whole other dimension that would be useful for me. And so I explored and tried to figure it out. And this is my current best understanding of how we best translate it into English or understand it. And it means something more like right involvement, or right application, right engagement, and so of the mind. Let's just do it as a thought experiment, potentially, that what I'm talking about is really interesting. I mean, this is the most fascinating Dharma topic you've ever heard in your life. And this, like, you're like right on the edge of your seats. And your mind is kind of gathered around and really kind of engaged and focused. You're involved. Your mind is involved in the topic that's being discussed. You're not thinking about the time. You're not thinking about your knees aching. You're not thinking about what's for lunch. You're like really involved and engaged. So the involvement, and so the mind can have various degrees of involvement. It can be very lackadaisical. It could be almost barely involved at all. It could be scatteredly involved, just a little bit involved, and it's involved in other things at the same time. or it could be fully engaged in a certain way. And the quality of how we engage is actually variable as well, because we bring along, when we engage our mental forces to be present for something, to be involved with something, we can bring along a lot of different things. We can bring along our, just watch some, young kid or a teenager, you ask them to do something they don't want to do. When I was a kid, my job every week was to mow the lawn. Mostly I was involved with resentment and boredom. that was my, what I was involved in. If I was, I was doing the mowing. But if you ask me, if I really honest and look back now, what was your mind engaged in? What was I applying the various capacities of mind to do? I was applying myself to being really good at resentment and boredom. And the effect of that was I was drained, I was tired, I was, it was exhausting to mow the lawn. And, why would you ask a teenager to do this? Ugh. So the way in which we involved, and so now it's not about necessarily about using the right intentions, renunciation, goodwill, and compassion, as a litmus test to study ourselves. It's not so much about coming back and being some kind of way, but rather it's it has to do with what's the flavor, the quality of the mind that kind of is infused as I do something. And when I thought about this, then I thought about meditation practice. That it's not so much the goal of meditation practice is to be that compassionate or to let go or to be kind, but rather in the way in which I meditate, the way in which I'm involved in meditation, can it have those qualities? And then I summarize for myself in a very, those three things into one word, and that's the word non-conflict. Can I be present in my meditation? Can I engage with what's happening? Can I be present with what's going on in a way where the mind is involved with it all without any conflict with what is happening? I might have ideas that something is right and wrong and certain things need to be fixed. My kitchen sink needs to be repaired. I'm not in conflict with that, but, we'll get around to it. But to have an attention, a way of the application of the mind in meditation, is the application of mind which is not in conflict with anything whatsoever. And that being not exactly the intention, though intention can be part of that. It's not aspiration. It's not exactly resolve. It's more like, and it's not for some conceptual purpose, some idea of what I have, this is why I'm doing this. But it has to do with something that's more like the quality or the very way in which I do something. Which somehow the words intention, which kind of implies having an aim or a plan, doesn't really apply. Or resolve doesn't quite apply, because that kind of means in English having a firm decision about something. And aspiration implies more like you have a goal for something. But application or involvement or how we engage, that's really how we are. I am right now here in the present. And that might be prior, a way the mind is involved with living, that's prior than having a desire or an intention or a resolve. It's more like it has to do with how we are rather than what we do. And so how we are, and so how do you want to be? And I think part of the treasure we have in our lives, more than what we do, is how we do, how we are. And so for me now, this second step of the Eightfold Path, which I now for this phase of my life, maybe next week it'll be different, it all changes, right? I'm very happy thinking of it as engagement or right involvement, because it has to do with, I feel more how I am. And how do I want to be right now? And can I be here without any conflict? So this is an example how, you know, this idea of intention and right attention keeps changing for me. And now I find I found it has I'm taking a different understanding of it. I'm not saying it's the right understanding, but it's expanded its meaning and its richness for me. And I suspect that as I continue this practice, that what intention means, or how I practice and look at it, how this right, you know, involvement, what that means, what the second factor of the Eightfold Path means, will continue to change and morph as I find new applications or new understandings of myself or this life of ours. And it just feels like it's so good. And then I'll end that one of the lessons for this, for me at least, is that independent of what Buddhism teaches or really is, whatever that is, it's really great just engaging in it, the engagement with it. There's something very special about the engagement in anything we do. It's in the engagement that freedom is found, in the engagement that wisdom and development, growth, reflection, and discovery can happen. And if the engagement itself can have qualities of not holding on tight, letting go, of not being hostile towards anything, but having goodwill rather than ill will. If our engagement can have qualities of compassion and care rather than hostility, then I think the engagement just keeps deepening and enriching and becoming better and better. So right engagement, right involvement, how we are. So that's what I had in mind today. And we have a few minutes before the end. If any of you would like to make some comments about that, or would like to make some have some questions, you're more than welcome to bring up anything. But we need to, if you could take the mic, that would help.
Is this on? You mentioned a method of engagement of non-conflict. I get stuck on the negatively phrased instruction. Can you offer me a positively phrased instruction there?
Well, I think the obvious one that comes to my mind, at least, is acceptance. But I prefer allowance. Not so much allowing things to be as they are, some things need to be changed, but allowing them to appear in the mind or be into awareness. The awareness doesn't contract. So some quality of the mind that stays open, fluid, without tightening, restricting, being aversive. And then wisdom can operate to decide what we need to really accept or not accept, or allow or not allow, but there's a kind of initially a space in the mind for things to be there that way. So I kind of like that, but but the problem with sometimes the problem with the positive is that it can seem too much like something we have to do, and non-conflict is more about what we don't do, and that sometimes allows for more inner and outer possibilities to emerge than if I think I have to do something, even something as accepting as acceptance. It can be very subtly, a little bit too much being controlled, a little bit too much kind of having an agenda of what's supposed to happen. So having non-conflict, non-resistance, at least in the way my mind works, sometimes makes more room for the for things to be in their pristine perfection. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the concept of allowing or accepting, at least in the moment, really helps me a lot more.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, yeah. So we all have different ways, reference points. And this is one of the themes today is our practice and the words we use, the concept we use, will change over time. There are times when acceptance and allowance was kind of really the operating, that really worked for me and was meaningful. And other times with this, like right now, like this idea of non-conflict and non-resistance seems to be more the, you know, what speaks to me and points to my mind. So this, what this means that, you know, for these, listening to these kind of, you know, Dharma teachers like myself, you know, we're always going to be limited in what we teach. You can feel a little bit sorry for us. You know, because we have to use words. We can't have too many footnotes in these talks. Too many footnotes in the talk. We can't like say, well, it can be this way and that way and this way and that way. And so you have to just listen to us and say, well, that didn't work today, and maybe it'll work someday, or that worked for me last week. And if I hear what the teachers say, and then if I just change one of the words, then it all works for me. So this is all part of your engagement, your involvement with the teachings, with the teachers, is to be, it's kind of like active learning that we're involved in. Active learning means it's not passive where you're just trying to, you know, just be told the truth, but rather it's, you know, thinking about it, engaging it, and finding out and that way it's easier for me to be a teacher because I don't have to worry too much about getting 100% right for each person. Okay, so, yes, in the back.
What I'm finding myself reminded of with your, especially the end of the talk, Gil, where you talk about no conflict, uh-huh, is the first verse of the Dhammapada, which I love. It's the only one I know as well. But it's something like, it begins something like, all experience is led by mind, created by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness will follow like a never departing shadow.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. There was, I think that opening of the Dhammapada speaks to this very nicely.
So, Gil, I appreciate what you're saying about non-conflict within myself, and yet I feel, especially in these times when there are groups of people that are being demonized, that if I see something like that happening, I feel very moved to stand up for them.
Yes, I'm happy to hear that. So this is where it's a little bit hard to you have to listen to to what I said very carefully, because what we're moved to do is different than how we receive things in our minds, how we receive things in our awareness. So the idea of not being in conflict with anything means that we're not in conflict in how we perceive it, in the perception of it, in the registering of this is what's happening. The mind doesn't contract, the mind doesn't resist, the mind doesn't close down, the mind doesn't get agitated. The mind stays balanced and peaceful and calm. And that allows wisdom to operate, allows our best discernment, our best understanding of what happens. It allows us to tap into some of the best empathic responses that we have about the situation. So if something's happening, if you see on the sidewalk someone is doing something, racist, or someone's doing something that's really demonizing someone else, then you might, because you have this ability to stay calm and open rather than immediately get all tight, to walk up and stand between the two people, look at the person who's angry, and look at them in a very relaxed, kind way, and say, you know, what's happening here? And you're clearly not wanting, you're trying to stop it from continuing to happen, but you're putting yourself in the middle of it, but you're trying to engage in a way where they don't feel attacked. But maybe it stops the behavior. What's going on here? Or, you know, wow, this is what I witnessed this once many years ago. I think I've told the story that there were people in terrible kind of conflict on the street. And one person was kind of trying to get away, and these really big, strong people were trying to get her. But she wasn't really running away, but it was really ugly. So I tried, got in the middle of it, but I didn't know quite what to do. And these big guys would step towards me. And so my best response I had to that was I would step backwards. And they would step closer, you know, because I was in the way between them and this person. And then this other person walked up and said, and did the same thing, stood up and said, and looked at the people and said, you know, if I was that person, if this was happening to me, I hope that you would step in and intervene for my sake. And he said it in a very calm, very relaxed way, and that diffused the whole thing. And so, you know, there are examples of when people can stay relaxed in a sense in their mind, which what it means to be, the awareness is allowing things to just arise, that sometimes really wise and dedicated and energetic responses can happen to what goes on. And that's what I hope. I mean, I want us to respond. I want you to respond and do something. I don't want to be passive and ignore it. That's not what I mean by allowing. I hope that things that need to be stopped, things that shouldn't be accepted, in our behavior we don't accept them, but we'd hopefully do it in the wisest way possible. And we can do that because we've learned to kind of stay calm or stay open or have an allowing mind or allowing heart. And that's why, you know, this is why the word allowing or non-conflict, you know, you have to really understand exactly where the location of that is. Does that make some sense? What do you think? So thank you for today, and thank you for your engagement, your involvement, and may you get great benefit from taking a good look at how you engage, how you apply yourself to whatever you're going to do. Thank you.